wonderful. Yeah. It's,
you know, it's warm air coming out of it.
Oh, yeah, because the sun was so warm yesterday.
Call to order. Call to order this hearing. State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee for Monday, March 15th, the Ides of March. Beware. First bill, Senator Sharon. Senate File 2866.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Senate File 2866 is a bill that makes changes to the...
66.
Is a bill that makes changes to the Minnesota Developing Trauma System, which is a growing program, a growing success story that engages the state's hospitals to work together in an integrated way to save lives and improve care for severely injured patients. This bill was reviewed for health issues in Senator Marty's committee. The health-related provisions of the bill have been reviewed there, but we're in front of this committee for elements of the bill that are under this committee's jurisdiction, which include...
It's sub 3 on page 2. Is that correct?
There's some name changes and professional certifying body clarification, technical changes on page 1, line 1.23, and...
That's not our concern. Our concern is the rule exemption, and then I believe you have another... provision in sub 4 under section 5 for rulemaking. I think that's the only reason.
Sub 4.
Oh, and you have a council established. So that speak to the rule. The reason why you need the Commissioner of Health needs that language. Is that language being struck there? Simply because it is out of date?
It's outdated. The report has already been made, and two of the recommendations in this bill come from that report.
Okay, and then on the trauma registry itself, in sub 4, wanting to be excused from 14-125, what's that? And if you'd identify yourself for the committee.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jim Golden. I'm the Director of Health Policy at the Department of Health.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I believe that the members have in their packet a side-by-side, which shows Section 5 as a recodification.
No, we don't.
Okay.
But...
Well, nonetheless, Madam Chair, Section 5 is, in fact, a recodification.
Okay.
What it is doing in Section 5 is dividing up the traumatic brain injury and spinal cord injury registry and the major trauma registry. What Section 4 is existing authority that already exists in Minnesota Statute 144.664 that does provide the commissioner rulemaking authority.
I just want to know what is the not being subject to 14.125, what's that?
Yes, and what Section 14.125 is the requirement that an agency promulgate rules within 18 months after being given an authority.
Okay.
And because this is a recodification, we already have
that. Okay, so then we're going to, and I'm not trying to be short, but we have a big agenda, and I was late to the committee, so I'm trying to just focus on what's our deal here. And so in Section 6, this council is already in place, but you're just making a different reference to
We're just cleaning up language, correcting the certifying body, and we're putting in proper terms.
Okay. Are there any questions for Senator Sharon about her bill? Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, Senator, under the Section 6, I see in line 4.13 where you cross out College of Surgeons. Is that is the organization made a name change, or is that organization no longer viable, or could you?
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tim Held. I manage the state trauma system at the Department of Health. And it was just the American College of Surgeons is a professional organization, but it's not the certifying body for surgeons. So it was wrongly put in originally. They're not the certifying body for surgeons. They're just a professional group. So it just needs to clean this up and note that it's the Board of Surgery that certifies them.
Okay.
Any other questions, Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On line 3.22, where it's talking about the commissioner adopting rules, and it just says to collect other information required to facilitate the development. I'm just a little uncomfortable, and I don't know how to state it any other way, because it leaves it so wide open to collect other information.
They have explained, and we don't have the side-by-side, that this is nothing other than current law. It's just being recodified.
Madam Chair, could someone explain what type of information they would need for this?
Sir?
Madam Chair, Senator, yeah, good. Thank you for the question. The primary purpose for the Trauma Registry is for quality improvement purposes, and so as hospitals begin to understand or analyze what's going on with their trauma programs, how well is trauma care going in the hospital as well as across the system, they may want to take a look at a more defined area that's not currently being collected. So for instance, that would be length of stay in the hospital before transfer. That's a key quality measurement tool to improve trauma care. So that would be an example of something that that the system would want to look at, and so would need to bring the stakeholders together to agree to that would be a valid point to improve the quality.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling, the bill with regard to the substance is going to the Judiciary Committee with regard to
Data privacy. Okay, Madam Chair. I'm
sure they're going to ask about that.
Even
if it is a recodification.
And especially the line that says on 312, the consent of the injured person is not required, and yet there's some very specific information required that, you know, says where they live, basically, the date, location, and cause of injury. They would, you know, some of that would make it pretty easy to identify individuals, and I'm hoping that they will address that issue. Because even if it doesn't require their names, it could be pinpointed pretty easily.
And also, I would imagine that some of the people who are affected by these brain injuries are incapable of giving consent because they're of their physical injuries too. But I think that part of it is the Judiciary Committee's purview. Any other questions for Senator Sharon or witnesses? This is the first engrossment, and what committee was it in before? Health and Family Security?
Policy.
Okay. Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 2866, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Senator Saltzman. Senate File 2928.
And I'm here with Senate File 2928, Madam Chair, the first engrossment. And this bill, Madam Chair, is from the Department of Labor and Industry, and it is a combination of cleanup language from the following DALI divisions, the construction code and licensing, and also the labor standards and apprenticeship. A number of parties have looked at these changes, and we believe we have consensus on them. It has a number of language clarifications related to rule hearings. It changes the word so that it is compliance with some of the federal language regarding the apprenticeship statute, removes outdated language, addresses use of electronic access for codes. It defines penalties for not filing support, a number of other, cleanup pieces regarding the word apprentice. It adds definitions. It changes administrative hearing requests from 30 to 45 days, and it repeals outdated language in a number of different sections. So if you'd like to let me know if there are specific sections you would like us to address, we would be happy to do that, Madam Chair.
Senator Saltzman, what brings the bill to this committee?
I believe because you have some electronic, in terms of meetings, in Section 1, one of the areas. And then 9 through 13, sections
Senator,
9
Senator
through 13.
Saltzman, do you have a bill summary of this bill?
I have a dated version. I do have, it's off by a couple numbers, but I have a summary of it.
So it looks like the first section is one that would be germane to this committee. Notice of a rule hearing, and that's to be able to receive a notice by electronic mail. Is that it? Okay.
That it is, Madam Chair. And then I also understand that perhaps sections 9 through 13 would also be something that you would like to look at.
I'm sorry, say again.
Sections 9 through 13.
Okay, and what do those sections do again?
Perhaps Mr. Joachim could address those, if that would be. Okay, Mr.
Madam Chair, committee members, Tom Joachim, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Labor and Industry.
Mm-hmm.
In Section 9, we are removing a section that charged with one of the duties of the state building official. We are moving that down to Section 13, so I'll describe that in a little bit.
Okay.
Section 10, as part of the state building code, the original language in our law from 1972 says we're supposed to file a copy with the Secretary of State. Portions of the state building code referenced national standards, and if we filed all of the national standards, we'd be hauling a pickup load of national standards over to the Secretary of State's office. So what we modified the language to state is that if it's referenced in the state in the model code we adopt or the state building code, we have to have it and file at our office, and we'll just file the state building code, the general language, at the Secretary of State's office. So that was the intent of that change, so we didn't have to file a lot of documents at the Secretary of State's office. Section
Chair,
11.
Madam Chair. On Section 10?
I'm sorry, you're not working off the, I'm told you're not working off the first engrossment.
I've introduced.
Are you?
Section 11.
Madam Chair, excuse me, it'll be Section 11 off the current engrossment.
Okay. And then what other sections in the first engrossment?
Section 10 actually would be the one where we're moving that language down later in the bill.
Okay.
Section 12 is consultation with the commissioner, and that's just clearing up where we hold the hearings. Prior to our consolidation 4 years ago, each of the state agencies that are now in the Department of Labor and Industry were required to hold hearings, and the commissioner is required to consult with them. Now that they're all there, we don't have to consult with anybody. We have all the state construction codes within the mm-hmm. department, so we're clearing that language up. Section 13 would be we're adding in other language within the state building code. There's a limitation on what can be, what amendments can be made to the state building code by the local jurisdictions, and they are geological amendments to the state building code, so we're trying to clear that up. And Section 14 would be the adoption of the code. Commissioner, and then this is where we move the language. Commissioner shall make an electronic version of the amendments to the code available to municipalities And upon request, a municipality may receive a paper copy of the amendments of 4 feet prescribed by the commissioner.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Joachim or Senator Salzman?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
I'm looking at section 33, we're changing the process on administrative hearings. Is that something before this committee, or is it going to be looked at somewhere else?
This bill is going to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, that may be a more appropriate stop there. Thank you.
Madam Chair, yes, we are.
Madam Chair.
Anything else? Senator Roebling.
On the section where we are asking the commissioner to make electronic versions available, and only, I'm assuming that the whole...
What section
the
of
whole
the bill?
Code
what,
is currently...
What section of the bill are you...
Section 14, 714.
Okay.
That I'm assuming that the whole code is currently electronically available, and then each year, or how often do you release amendments to the code? And how far ahead of when they have to be implemented so inspectors have a period of time and contractors have a period of time to absorb all of these?
Madam Chair, Senator.
Mr. Joachim.
The code is updated generally on a three-year cycle. We have provisions within the law of state building code law that require when we adopt new codes, we have to allow 6-month lag time or a window for training and education before the effective date of the code goes into place so that we can provide training and education to the local code officials, contractors, et cetera, before the new code goes into play.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
How much would a paper copy typically cost if someone wanted a book form?
Mr. Joachim.
Madam Chair, I think we charge 15 cents a copy, a page, so I'm not sure what the...
How many pages?
Madam Chair, I would guess the state building code with all the amendments is probably 150 pages. That's why we prefer to send them electronically.
Okay. Anyone else? Anyone in the audience, I should have asked that about the other bill as well, want to speak either in favor or support of the issues under this committee's jurisdiction? Seeing none, Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 2928, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and refer to the Judiciary Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Committee.
Senator Torres-Ray. Senator Torres-Ray brings us Senate File 27. 38.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
And where has this bill been before, Senator Torres-Ray?
It was in the Education Committee.
In the Education Committee.
Sent here from there.
If it passes
that
committee, it will go to the floor.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
And so give us a brief description and then why the bill is in front of this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I move, if I may, I would like to ask if you could help me move forward a very brief amendment that apparently I have redundant language in 2-4. This is section 2. Apparently there is an overstatement in here that says each district shall consist of contiguous and compact territory. And then it goes on to say to more not than twice as long as it is wide, and that means the same thing. So in the House, they deleted not more than twice as long as it is wide.
Where is
so,
that?
So this is line point 2-4, Madam Chair. I think you have the A4 amendment.
So
it's in the amendment.
So the amendment will delete that redundant language, not more than twice, as long as it is wide.
Senator Lurie moves the A3 amendment to rid the bill of its redundant language. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, Senate File 2738 is an attempt to help the Minneapolis School District deal with a decision that was made to change the composition of the board, and this basically explains how that actual process is going to work. So the legislation permits the Minneapolis School Board members to sit on the City Redistricting Commission for the purposes of redrawing school board district boundaries. Two school board members will replace the two members of the Redistricting Commission that are currently appointed by the majority and minority caucuses of the City Council. Both the city and the board have worked on this process and have come up with this recommendation to the legislature. And to speak and explain this better, Madam Chair, members, Jim Grathwell from the Minneapolis School District is here, and he will speak briefly about the bill.
Madam Chair, members, Jim Grathwell with Minneapolis Public Schools. In 2006, the legislature enacted, and in 2008, the voters of Minneapolis approved a reorganization or restructuring of the board from seven board members elected at large to a nine-member board with six elected at large. The bill you have in front of you is really just a cleanup, realizing, oh, now we have six board members elected at large. I'm sorry, six board members elected by district. We should find a place to put ourselves on a redistricting commission within the city to redraw those boundaries in subsequent years.
Okay, Senator Morty, question or comment?
Madam Chair, Mr. Grathwell, I'm just curious, the apportionment usually becomes a very, very political thing, and the fact that the Minneapolis Redistricting Commission has a majority and minority caucus appoint members. The school board obviously is not divided up by partisan things in any way. Is the school board going to be fighting with each other who gets to get on it? And obviously they're not a majority of the redistricting thing anyway. But
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, if you read the bill, I don't think there's going to be a fight within the school board about seats on the redistricting commission. And looking at the bill, the school board only votes on school district boundaries. The city members of the commission vote on city council boundaries. So it seems to be taken care of.
Madam Chair, my question wasn't Senator about Marty. The city. My point was the fact that for the school district boundaries, is it? I understand right now. I mean, there aren't that many people begging to be on the school board right now. But do you foresee it at some point where it's going to become a partisan thing, whether it's by political party or geographic thing or racial or other kind of disparities, where there's going to be some sort of political fight over this at some point, say 10 years from now or 15, not next reapportionment, but the following one.
Maybe. Let me take that.
Mr. Grathwell?
Madam Chair, and maybe Senator I should try to answer this question for Senator Marty. Senator Marty, I do believe that this is a good opportunity for us in Minneapolis because I think that what is concerning the city of Minneapolis, the school members, and in general the community is predominantly how different areas of the district are represented. And we are very concerned about, class, definitely ethnicity, transportation, all sorts of issues that really impact children and families in a very direct way. So I think that there is a very genuine effort today in Minneapolis to really move in a direction that is of advantage to those families. And I don't think that the political affiliation or other political issues are influencing this decision. So my hope, in fact, is that this is an opportunity for us to really do boundaries in a way that are beneficial to the community. I think that may change, when and if we have some political divisions in the city of Minneapolis, and I think that those political affiliations sometimes kind of put us in the wrong path to make decisions that are not in the best interest of children. But today I think there is a very genuine effort being pursued by city and board members and the community in general to do boundaries that are of benefit to the communities that they serve. I don't know about 10 years from now, though, Senator.
Madam Chair, I think it's great to hear that this is happening in a
cooperative manner and so on. I think we won't know, but 20 years from now we might be saying, oh, why didn't somebody say you have to appoint them this way or something? Mm-hmm. But anyway, I think the bill makes sense. Be happy to move the bill if you're ready.
Senator Marty moves that Senate file 2738, the first engrossment as amended, be recommended to pass. Is there any further discussion? Anyone in the audience wish to speak in opposition to the bill? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble, Senate file 2826.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 2826. Madam Chair and members, Hennepin County is developing a wind energy project. It's in the city of Medina in western Hennepin County, at the site of its public works facility out there. And this bill would allow Hennepin County to do is to enter into a limited liability partnership, become a member of a limited liability company or a shareholder in a corporation established for that purpose to build, to finance or operate such a facility. The reason Hennepin County would like to do this, Madam Chair and members, is so that they can access a variety of investment or finance tools, particularly federal incentives, including possibly production tax credits or investment tax credits or grants. Non-taxpaying entities obviously can't benefit from tax credits and the like, but if they become a member of a limited liability corporation for the purpose of financing such a project, they can. This is not without precedent. A number of other local jurisdictions in recent years have been permitted to undertake this activity through this mechanism, Winona County, school districts, and others for this purpose. This is part of a larger effort by the Hennepin County Board to green its energy resource and also to save a little bit of money. Hennepin County spends over $7 million for electricity every year. They consume quite a bit. This proposed turbine would produce electricity that would be the equivalent to about 5% of their energy use. They wouldn't sell the electricity, or they wouldn't use the electricity directly, and they would not sell it at retail. The mechanisms that, or the statutes that govern how local units can operate and use this energy are pretty well spelled out already in statute. What they would do is sell it into the grid at wholesale and then buy it back. But the sale of this energy would finance the cost of the wind turbine. I have Carl Michaud here from Hennepin County Public Works who can share some more information with you.
Mr. Michaud, did you want to testify or just want to be available to answer questions?
Madam Chair, Senators, I'll be available for questions.
Okay. Is there any question or comment for Senator Dibble or Mr. Michaud? Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, Senator, how many turbines are you talking?
This is, Madam Chair and members, this is just one.
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry.
I've been reading reports, and I was just at a meeting here a couple of weeks ago talking about the inefficiencies or an efficiency level of a turbine in the state of Minnesota at about 37%. If that's the case, is this a good thing to be doing? How much is it going to handle, and is there a return on the investment and things?
Senator Dibble?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Perry, absolutely. I mean, the electricity that's generated from the facility will more than pay for the facility.
One final question. Is it windy enough?
Well, Mr. Michaud can talk about the studies that were done at the site to determine the wind resource and the energy available from there. It's pretty good there.
Mr. Michaud. Madam Chair, Senator Perry, years ago, we had conducted a wind study of the wind resource in that area. In fact, we had used the Minnesota Department of Commerce, some of their equipment, and we had placed that on the sheriff's radio tower there, which is even taller than what the proposed turbine is going to be.
And we measured the wind resource there over a period of 2 years, and based on that information, we concluded that it was adequate to actually construct a turbine on the site. We also engaged a consultant who's helped a lot of the developers out on the Buffalo Ridge come in and evaluate that same data and bring in some of their own information, and they've made the same conclusions. So that's the basis for moving forward.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
To Senator Perry's earlier question about efficiency of turbines, you won't find any turbines that are, I don't know, Senator Carlson, you can help us, that are actually that efficient. I think, you know, steam-driven turbines that are from boiling water that's heated by coal or nuclear or dams, you know, hydroelectric dams. The never-ending holy grail is greater efficiency in turbines, but I think at best you get to 30-40% efficiency in any turbine anywhere.
And Senator Dibble, the bill is here because it deals with Hennepin County, and Hennepin County has its own statute. So I don't know that that's where it's being put. Is that?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
It's in the Hennepin County statute.
383B is the Hennepin County chapter.
Otherwise, it would have, the policy was addressed in the EUTC committee.
Right.
Senator Rolstein.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
Okay, is there any further discussion? Anyone in the audience wish to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 2826?
Madam Chair, where does the bill go?
To the floor. Is it second committee?
Well, I'm just wondering, the reference to the liability is governed by 46604, and it refers to liability for limited company. I don't know if that raises new issues.
Madam Chair.
Which issue would be interesting or not? I don't know.
This is a restatement of existing liability. It was just put there to button it up. We've already spoken with Senator Moore, and she does not want to see the bill.
Okay. Thank you, though, for the question, Senator Batzold. Senator Olsen then moves, once again, that Senate File 2826 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Dibble. Senator Dahl, is he here? Senator Dahl brings us Senate File 2720. And we have the first engrossment. But Senator Dahl, did you also want us to consider an amendment?
Madam Chair, I know it's a little unusual, especially in your committee, but I wanted to consider it. Yes, please. And the main reason for it is not so much there's a lot of changes, but there was a lot of little changes, words throughout the bill that it was just easier to just do a delete all and incorporate those things in that way instead of doing it separately. So I think it would make more sense for the members to be able to see it clean like this.
Okay, so what this really amounts to is your amendment and what would otherwise be an unofficial engrossment so that we could see how the amendment fits the bill. Is that correct?
Correct.
Because delete all amendments in a committee that's not the original jurisdiction.
Right.
Madam Chair, we'll talk to the... but I understand that Senator Pretner Solon thought that this was a wise move to make here.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
And so why don't you just take us briefly through the delete all amendment, the A6 amendment, and then I'll ask someone to move it, and then we'll then deal with the issues that are under the jurisdiction of this committee.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make that motion.
Okay, I want him to explain it before we do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this bill is a program for financing energy efficiency and renewable programs in the private sector, both for residential and commercial buildings. And it's a way to allow, with especially the tight credit markets that we have nowadays, to use qualified energy efficiency programs to be assessed on our property tax and paid off over, say, over a 20-year period of time. And what the bill does is, as we go through it, it qualifies it basically a city to do this if they choose to. It's a voluntary program, so they'd have to approve this type of a plan. Also, we have included counties as well, because some cities have said that the administration of this program may be beyond their means, and aggregating on a county level would be more helpful. So we wanted to make sure that there was the ability to do that. There would be an energy audit that's included in this program that's defined here, what an energy audit is. This includes both for energy improvements or energy efficiency programs and renewable energy programs or systems. So in both cases, there would be some sort of either an energy audit, as the Subdivision 4 points out, or in Subdivision 8, a renewable energy feasibility study. This does the types of renewable energy projects that would be included would include solar thermal, solar photovoltaic, wind, and geothermal resources. On page 2, really talks about the guts of the program. Again, this is a voluntary program, and it establishes the local government as the program authority, and they can establish a financing program for qualifying real property to pay for what we call cost-effective energy improvements to their property, and through the use of revenue bonds to actually pay for the program and have it assessed to their property tax. Now, the program requirements, as you see in Subdivision 2, must include the one, impose the requirements and conditions on financing arrangements to ensure timely repayment. Two, they require an energy audit or renewable energy system feasibility study to be conducted on the property and reviewed by the local government prior to approval of the financing. Inspection of the installation, the verification of the performance of the energy improvements that are financed, and require that all cost-effective energy improvements be made to the property prior to or in conjunction with the putting any kind of renewable energy in. And in addition to that, the work financed by the program will be done by licensed contractors. We require full disclosures to the borrowers by the local government of the risks involved in the borrowing. Number 7 is financing only to those who have can demonstrate the ability to pay. Number 8 is to provide financing for qualifying real property in which the owner is not current, not to provide the financing where they're not current on their mortgage. So we don't want anyone, obviously, that's in arrears. And this would require that each owner kind of petition for this. They would come to the city for the special assessment. Any defaults and tax delinquencies that would not be accelerated, only the amounts that are in arrears would be due upon any kind of assessment. And the liability for the special assessments related to the financing runs with the qualifying property. And that's one of the unique property parts of this, too, is that a lot of with these energy efficiency and renewable projects, they do take a while for you to get the payback. And so a lot of folks thinking they may sell or move within a period of time before that payback period, the financing runs with the house, so then, or the property in the commercial building, so that if it's sold, the next property owner can pick that up. They've got the benefits. They'd also pick up the payments with that as well.
Madam Chair. Right. Senator Roebling.
Before he moves on to the next section, I have a question. Number 2.21, number 5, have the work financed by the program done by licensed contractors. And I'm wondering, you also have a requirement that the installations be inspected, and before that, that an energy audit be also required before the work is done. And I'm just wondering about the requirement for the licensed contractors, because some of this is insulation and possibly window replacement, things that someone like a retired a homeowner doing his own work who may have been a carpenter or, you know, skilled in those mm-hmm. trades but not licensed any longer could do on his own property. And would do we need to have that it be a licensed contractor if it's going to be inspected? I mean, I guess I'm just wondering about
Madam
that.
Chair and Senator Roebling, I want to allow enough flexibility in this program that where the cities could make an exception if they chose to. The cities are going to set this up. They would have to, you know, kind of model it the way they see is best. We want to give them enough prescription that there's a uniformity across the state as we go forward. But if I think a city decided that they saw that they wanted to make that type of contractor that you're talking about, a retired, a qualifying contractor, or make an exception, I think a variance on their plan, I would assume that that's something they could do. Because they're the ones that are going to establish the program as the cities. And then we initially set this up with Chapter 326B because there's, you know, the concern for, you know, the other licensed trades wanted to make sure that there wasn't just anybody coming up with a bucket or a hammer that they could do that. We want to make sure that people who are actually qualified to do this program or this work are the ones doing it. And, you know, the city itself is going to want to make sure that's being done by qualified contractors as well. So there may be, in that case, they may say that that gentleman or that contractor didn't qualify, and so that he wouldn't be able to take advantage of this particular financing. And we're not trying to make this available to everyone either. It's simply to be another tool or another mechanism in case the other options aren't working out right, that in qualifying circumstances, this would be a financing mechanism that could be used.
Well, Madam Chair, since it does say a financing program must, I don't know that it would give the cities the latitude to change that or make exceptions. It's not clear to me that they would be able to. So I'm just wondering if we could give them a little more latitude, because sometimes if someone can do the work themselves, they can save half the cost of the project. Mm-hmm. And maybe they don't want a huge assessment against their home, but they want to get the work done. And so, you know, to say, well, you can do it, but you can't use the loan program, I suppose we can do that. But I'm just thinking that somebody could be qualified to do it, but not any longer hold the license. They may be retired people or something. Well,
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, the other part of this is, of course, you know, there's a lot of filters that this is going to go through, but part of this is we also, you know, there has to be the ability to sell the bonds as well. And so, you know, they're going to want to be looking for qualified contractors that actually do the work. Now, I don't know what, you know, at this point, whether we can have that flexibility. We first want to be able to make sure we can actually get the program running. I mean, we've got a lot of support from it as it is on paper, but no one's implemented something like this yet. And so, and we know we've had some programs in the past where they've had revenue bonds that in the soft bond market didn't, you know, weren't moving very well. And so with this program, it's on the mortgage, on a lien position on the property. You know, that's one of those qualifications that allow it to make it more attractive. And I think also qualifying contractors, and, you know, if we start opening up too far right now, I think that makes it less attractive.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Shall we let Senator Dahl finish explaining the bill, and then we'll come back?
Madam Chair.
Senator Carlson.
I guess I'd like to pursue that just a bit. I think somewhere in statute allows a homeowner to do their own work on their own home, as long as it's not for hire. For instance, a homeowner can do their own wiring. A homeowner can do their own plumbing. A homeowner can install their own furnace. But you can't do it for hire in your friend's house or anything like that. I mean, I've done my own wiring. I've installed my own furnaces. In fact, I even did my own contracting. And I think that that's allowed as long as it's your own home. But I don't know where it is in statute.
Madam Chair, you want me to continue? You'd like me to continue?
Yes,
okay. On Subdivision 3, Madam Chair, members, is the financing terms. We set up here is that finance provided under the section that the terms, it's a weighted average, I guess, of the useful life of the energy improvement, but it's not to exceed 20 years. I think in most cases that's what it would just be set up as. The principal amount is not to exceed the lesser of 10% of the assessed value of the real property on which the improvements are to be installed. And the interest rate will be sufficient to pay for the financing costs of the program, including the issuance of bonds and any financing delinquencies. So the cities would be able to add a point or whatever it might be to the interest rate to cover those costs. We want to make sure that we're working in conjunction with the utilities in the area for any particular financing, other types of programs that are there available for rebates and the like, so that we're utilizing as much of the dollars that are available out there. Upon completion of the program, then the local government would issue a certificate stating participation in the program and what energy improvements have been made. Finally, the local government financing and energy improvement under this section must One, secure payment with a lien against the benefited qualifying real property, and two, collect real repayments as a special assessment as provided for in Section 429. And then in Subdivision 7, this is on the repayment, local government may issue revenue bonds as provided in Chapter 475 for this purpose. The bonds may be payable as both principal and interest solely from the revenue from the assessments established in Subdivision 4. And no bondholder of bonds issued under this subdivision may compel any exercise of a taxing power of the local government that issued the bonds to pay principal or interest on the bonds. I just wanted to be very clear on that. Bonds issued under this subdivision are not a debt or obligation of the local government that issued them, nor is the payment of the bonds enforceable out of any money other than the revenue pledged to the payment of the bonds. So on the And I think that is the extent of it. The last section just says restates that they have the ability under Section 429, that number 21, 5.23, to assess the affected property owners for repayment of voluntary energy improvement financing under this program. I guess there's one last section also in that 429 is on the final page. Number C, letter C, 6.23 is the line that a home rule charter city, statutory city, county, or town operating an energy improvement finance program under Section 216 has the authority granted under the municipality under this paragraph with respect to energy improvements. And that is the bill. It's a way to allow qualifying energy improvements and renewable projects to move forward in this tight credit market that we have today. And it's a voluntary program. The cities would have to first, set the program up. Property owners would petition to get a special assessment, and if they went through the program, they'd have those checks and balances. I have with me a couple of testifiers, Madam Chair, Craig Ebling, City Manager, Burnsville, to talk about the city perspective, and also Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities to also provide a little perspective from the cities.
Okay, and there is a handout in the packets about this program. Senator Gimsey, would you mind if we adopted the amendment, and then I'll call on you? Would that be okay?
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Senator Pappas moves the A6 amendment that Senator Dahl just described. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Dahl, do you visualize this program being specifically for or more focused on individual homeowners who maybe have an older home, or is your hope through this program to generate interest amongst developers or people who are buying foreclosed homes and rehabilitating them?
Madam Chair and Senator Gimsey, what I envision is more for the homeowner who has, is in good standing with their credit and things like that, but they're having, they want to make the improvements, but, they can't make the amount that, at this point, because of tight credit, to be able to put that money into a large home improvement, or whether it's maybe they want to put some solar panels on the home. They've done those energy improvements, but they want to put, solar panels or solar thermal system in. And this would give them the ability to do that. A lot of these, renewable energy programs, the payback can be over 10 years. And, if they're thinking maybe they'll move in 7 years, this gives them the ability to invest in that, start to get some of that those savings, but also and improve the value of their home, but also that they know that they have the luxury that they could, if they choose to move, they're not going to have to pay off that whole loan up front. That it can be negotiated at the time of the sale, whether they want to just pass it on with the homeowner, because it'll be tied to the property itself. So it gives them some flexibility.
Senator Gimsey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason why I'm asking that question is because of the long-term benefit of these types of improvements. And say you have an individual who goes out and buys 10 homes in a depressed area, uses this program and implements these cost savings ideas, the first person typically to sell the home after those types of improvements gains the greatest benefit from them. They're able to mark up the selling price of that refurbished home, mm-hmm. and get the greatest benefit, while subsequent owners beyond them that
profit, if you will, from that improvement is diminished. And I guess I just have a little concern about the assessment being attached to the property over a long period of time when you have somebody comes in, buys a home, does the improvements, turns around in a year later, sells it for a very nice profit because of those improvements, and the people who subsequently own that property for years and years afterwards end up paying those special assessments while this guy, do you understand where what I'm talking about? Do you see a problem with that at all in this?
Well, not exactly, Madam Chair and Senator Gimsey. Again, the cities are going to be doing a lot of, they're going to set a lot of the parameters of what qualifies and doesn't qualify. There's have to be a petition to you know, have your property qualified. We're not looking at, you know, at this point, you know, I don't know what those particular properties, what they'll look like. I mean, maybe there's going to be someone out there that's going to try to use this as a tool. But, again, the cities are the ones who are going to structure, you know, what's a qualifying project. And if that's something that they don't want to include, I would think that they would exclude that as being a qualifying project. I'm not looking for developers to come in and do this, you know, take a whole block and to use this assessment property. It's for individual property owners. If you're a business owner, you want to do some improvements on your building, a homeowner that's in good standing with your mortgage already, that those are the types of property owners that I think would qualify for this program.
Madam Chair?
Just a second. Senator Gimsey, are you finished?
Well, not quite, Madam Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm still struggling with this aspect of, you know, diminishing value, and I'm just wondering if we're just not through a program like this, and I understand the intent, you know, I think it's a good intent. I'm a home builder myself, and, you know, would look for any incentive to get things going, if you will, and I think that there's significant merit in what you have here. But I'm just a bit concerned that 10, 15, 20 years down the road that with a program like this, if it isn't properly structured, maybe with a diminishing amount of assessments over time, that we're going to have, again, in 15, 20 years, a group of homes, a bunch of homes in the state of Minnesota that the value has been tapped out of them, and they're sitting there with, you know, depressed again, a depressed value that, or a diminished value with a big assessment at the end of it, or tracking along for that 20 years. That aspect of this bill is kind of troubling to me. But.
And Madam Chair, Donald. Senator Gimsey, and I've thought about those same things as well. And again, this is an energy efficiency program, and that, you know, you're going to be saving money to begin with right off the bat, because those improvements are going to reduce the amount of energy consumption in your home or your business, and that's the whole design is to repurpose those dollars towards this increase in the special assessment. So should have the ability to be able to pay it off not only without those savings, but that you should be able to use those savings to pay off. Maybe you can even accelerate the payments if you wanted. And we're also looking at one of the provisions in here, again, is that it would be to the useful life of the improvement itself. So if that's less than 20 years and the cities want to structure it that way, put those terms in there, they certainly can. But not to ever exceed 20 years, because, yeah, I don't want to see that there's a lot of properties now that have used this type of mechanism if it goes forward, because at this point, again, we're still in that new stage where we have to have people actually step on and take it on. It's a project. But I like the way that's been structured. I think we've looked at a lot of those issues, and the cities would then be able to take those and develop their own program appropriate for their city.
Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, I think maybe we can address some of Senator Gimsey's concerns at 3.9 under Section 2 there, where it says that the principal amount not to exceed the lesser of 10% of the assessed value. So it's not like somebody's coming in and going to do 100% of the value in improvements. They're only going to be able to do 10% of the assessed value. And if it's putting in a geothermal furnace or a solar photovoltaic panel system, that's kind of unique. And although I would not be opposed at all if somebody came in and wanted to buy up a city block and, you know, re-energize those homes and do some energy efficiencies there. But I think that really constrains the amount of money that would be put into this. So I think my only concern with Senator Dahl's bill was that I live in a township, so I want to put these solar panels on, but now I see he's added towns on the town, so I'm very fine with the bill as it is.
Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dahl for bringing this forward. And to Senator Gimsey's point, also correct me if I'm mistaken, but by the way this works, I don't think that, a buyer would take on any liability that they wouldn't know about. I mean, it would come on the property tax statement. It would be clear that this is a liability that you're taking on. So they'd be able to weigh the relative costs and benefits. And I think that buyers that are looking for homes that have these energy improvements will see clearly both sides of the equation and that they're taking on this expense. They're getting the benefit from these energy improvements, and they're going to take on some of the expense of it. So they'll be able to weigh it, and I think that consumers are, and it'll be clear on the property tax statement that this is an existing assessment that is due over this period of time. So I don't think that's a terrible concern that people will be able to utilize this to get a big benefit and then pass it off to buyers of the property without these buyers really understanding that they're taking on these liabilities. So I don't see this big windfall issue as a major concern in this bill. There'll be buyers and it'll be clearly disclosed in the sales agreements that are written up, and they'll be able to weigh the relative costs and benefits and make a determination as to whether it is the right property for them.
Senator Dahl, did you want to have Mr. Johnson and Mr. Ebling testify?
Madam Chair, I thought that would be helpful because, Mr. Ebling is from the city of Burnsville and can kind of tell you kind of what they would see from a program like this. And
okay, we'll take brief testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Ebling, welcome to the committee. If you could keep your comments brief, I think we would appreciate it.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Craig Ebling. I'm city manager from the city of Burnsville. Senator Dahl has furnished me with a copy of the measure that you're considering today and asked what the city of Burnsville would make of enabling legislation like this. I would add from the start that the city council has no formal position on this, but I can recite that the council has adopted a sustainability plan, and our sustainability plan does make mention of such a program and the possibility that a program like this could be considered if there were enabling legislation for it. So I think I can say with certainty that our city council is on record as saying that they would consider such a program. There would be administrative challenges in implementing a program like this for a small city as Burnsville. We believe that if the legislature and governor were to enact this, that those difficulties could be overcome by working in Dakota County, at least Dakota County Community Development Agency. They are very adept at reviewing applications for financing such as this, and would have expertise that we don't have at our city. We don't have a housing department or anything like that. We would also, as we work through this, clarify the payment provisions and what our responsibilities are for quality of the work with to the homeowners and business owners, et cetera, and make sure that there's no gap there as to who is responsibility for the quality of the work. Cities are fairly adept at using Chapter 429, which is my understanding this is really an application of that statute. Status of the bonding under 475 as revenue bonding would be very important to the city. The ability to shelter this debt from the full faith and credit of the city, I think, would be an important consideration for our council as they considered implementing a program like that. It's clear to us, at least, that the credit markets for cities are also in a state of volatility these days, and I don't think any of us know what the market would say about these municipal bonds. But certainly, I think that Minnesota cities have a good track record of making good on their debt, and I would think that they would be saleable, although perhaps the interest rate would be unknown at this juncture. The ability to classify the dollars as a first lien on the property would be critical to cities, again, in completing that loop in terms of the status of the bonds. Just a word of testimony about the machinery that comes into play when one of these special assessments is a matter of record. That they certainly do come up during the consideration of any real estate transactions that follow there. There's a title search done, be it abstract or Torrens property. The city participates in it, and we would certify that there are unpaid special assessments that are on the property, and that's a matter that would be known to all of the parties at the real estate closing. Our practical experience, again, the machinery that often comes into play here is that banks do not like to carry forward special assessments because of their lien position, so they oftentimes are cleared out. But clearly, in summary, this is a program that I believe our council would consider and that would be in keeping with their sustainability goals.
Thank you very much. Mr. Johnson, did you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Only very briefly, I think the bill has been well explained. There are a couple of changes in the delete all that I think are important and really helped us get this bill in good shape for cities. One was the inclusion of counties specifically, because we do have so many communities that really would work best at this with a more regional approach to it, where they do have economic development programs and other similar types of staffing. And secondly, there was language added to really clarify that this is a completely voluntary program. You can only be included if you petition to have your property put in. You will not have suddenly an announcement that your neighborhood is all having new roofs put on and you get to pay. So I just wanted to make it very clear that we added actually on page 2, lines 28 and 29 is the bullet specifically added to make it very clear that all owners of a property must sign the petition to be included in this program. And of course, no local unit of government is required to have this program. It's entirely at their discretion if they want to offer it as a tool.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Is there further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to this bill who has not spoken? Senator Olsen, you have a question?
No, at the appropriate time, I'd like to move the bill.
Senator Carlson?
Yes, I have a question for, I believe, Mr. Ebling probably is the most appropriate. The you said that this would be a primary tax lien against the property. In the case of a foreclosure, how does that get dealt with then? That's an unpaid tax, unpaid lien against the property, and do you get the first satisfaction? Would the city get first satisfaction if this is a foreclosure?
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, I believe that that's a statute that has evolved over the years a little bit. I believe that the special assessments would be ahead of general taxes and behind a couple other things that are a matter of county claims, but I believe that they would be in front of the commercial mortgage that is in place.
And Madam Chair, now
Senator Carlson.
To Senator Gimsey's point, I was concerned also about this having properties that would be encumbered with unpaid taxes or unpaid tax liens and diminishing the value of the property because the tax lien might be a debt that's on an abandoned asset, for instance. My concern was that there are things that you can do to your home that are, quick payoffs, windows, new furnace, things like that. But then there's slow paybacks. Geothermal would be a highly capitalized debt, but a long payoff, a good payoff. Then there are things that, for instance, photovoltaics that never pay off. Solar water heating that is a long payoff, and oftentimes, in my experience, I've seen the homeowner abandons it. So it's even likely that the second person that buys that home doesn't even get the advantage of the solar water heater that was abandoned by the prior owner, but still has to pay the debt on it. And I guess that's one of the concerns I have on this system, is that it requires the city to actually become a multitasker with having to be a banker, having to be having a housing department or contracting out for housing advice, and then the owner is on the hook for it, but then the owner can default also. I have a lot of problem with this bill and with this system, and I guess I still need to feel more comfortable with it.
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, I think that, again, the machinery of Chapter 429 does allow some flexibility there. Cities are users, I guess, more than cities are authorized under 429, can structure the repayments in different ways. Specifically, some cities will utilize equal annual payments on principal and interest combined. Other cities will require an equal annual payment on the principal and interest on the declining balance, which has a significant difference. That would tend to front load, the latter scenario would tend to front load the payments and may safeguard against some of that concern. But again, that's flexibility that's under the statute for cities.
Thank you very much. Senator Olsen wanted to move the bill. Senator Olsen moves that.
Madam Chair.
Let me just finish, please. That Senate File 2720 as amended be recommended to pass. Further discussion?
Madam Chair, there's a couple of technical items that should be addressed.
Okay, Mr. McGowan, if you'd help us out.
They're both on page 5. Page 5, line 15, the "and" is stricken. The "and" refers to clauses 1 and 2, and the City Council is required to make both findings in order to improve, construct, extend, and maintain facilities for Internet access. So the "and" should not be stricken. It's appropriate. In fact, it's probably necessary. So... page 5, line 15.
Senator Pappas moves to reinstate the stricken language on 515. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Mr. McGowan.
Madam Chair, there's one more on line 22. The period is stricken, even though the previous 19 clauses are standalone clauses with periods at the end. In the interest of consistency, the period should remain, so it would be page 5, line 22, reinstate the period and delete the new language.
Senator Pappas moves to reinstate the period and delete the new language on line 522. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Mr. McGowan, is that it?
That's it, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the help there. Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 2720 as amended be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. Senator Murphy. Senator Murphy brings us Senate File 2586.
Related to this.
Proposing a constitutional amendment and there is an author's amendment that's being passed out.
Madam Chair, there should be two amendments.
I have the A2 amendment.
Yes, there's an A1 that I'll offer up after the A2. But.
Okay, this is an author's amendment.
Madam Chair, Mr. Botter and Sam, I've got my wires crossed here.
Madam Chair and Senator Murphy, no, I was just suggesting you can offer them both in the same motion. You don't have to deal with it twice.
A1 is in the packets. So,
Madam Chair, you want me to explain what both of them do?
No, these are author's amendments.
Okay.
I think we have to do them separately, though. Senator Olsen moves the A2 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Madam Chair,
no.
There's...
the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
And
Mr. Bodden?
Beg your pardon. I just wanted to catch. There's a small change on the A1 that needs to be made before it's adopted.
Okay. We just adopted the A2. So
right.
Now we have the A1 before us, and there needs to be a correction. Senator, Mr. Bodden.
Madam Chair, just on the A1 amendment, delete line 2 and that that's basically covered already in the A2 amendment.
Okay. The A1 amendment is will be before us without line 1.2 of the amendment. Senator Olsen moves the A1 amendment with that change incorporated. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted, and now the bill is before us in the shape that Senator Murphy would like. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, this is a pretty simple concept to grasp. I'll walk you through the bill in just a second, but currently we have one member of the legislature who I believe is going to be deployed, and we want to make allowances for that for that active duty military service.
Is that Representative Lesch? Who is that?
No, I believe it's Representative Reinhardt from Duluth.
From Duluth, okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Senator Murphy, forgive me, but does Armed Services of the United States include the National Guard?
Madam Chair, yes, it does, Senator Pappas. If the National Guard, they have to be put on their federal service, so they are at the direct beck and call of the president.
Okay. Go ahead, Senator Murphy.
Well, Madam Chair, this is just in those cases when we would have someone who was serving in the military in the legislature who would get called up to active duty, and we don't have any provisions for that right now as far as succession or what happens with the members' benefit package or anything like that. So we propose this bill, and with the changes that were made, I'll try to walk you through this as best as possible. On the very first page, down towards the bottom, that is the charge of the legislature. It just says that the legislature shall provide by law the prompt and temporary succession of powers of the duty of a member of the legislature upon their active duty call-up. Section 2 is the submission to the voters. The A2 amendment changed authorized on the very first sentence there and to require. But it'll read, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to require the legislature to enact laws providing for prompt and temporary succession to the powers and duties of a legislator who has ordered active duty in the Armed Forces of the United States. It goes on to talk in Section 3 about the parameters by which that individual would, the individual who would be the successor would be picked. The first thing that would happen was a legislator that was going to be shipped off on active duty would take three qualified names, write them down on a piece of paper. He'd go see either the Speaker of the House or the Senate Majority Leader and tell them, also in writing at this time, that, I've been called up. I'm going to be leaving on X date, and here's three names for you to pick a successor. The rest of it talks about the successor on the three individuals that the legislator has to give the appropriate authority. It's the same thing as for us. I mean, you have to be of age. You have to be a voter in the district. You got to live in the district. All the same guidelines that we have to play by. And then that would then you would be termed a qualified nominee. And then Section 4 is once the the key line here is starts on line 8. It just it states real clear that no temporary successor shall serve in this capacity beyond the end of the term of the office of the legislator for whom the successor was designated. In other words, the person couldn't just claim squatter's rights and stay forever. There's also Section 5, and those are the same privileges and immunities and compensation that we all receive. Now, the A1 amendment does allow the legislator that's serving on active duty. A lot of times if the person is from greater Minnesota, during the legislative session. You know, we all kind of moved to St. Paul, and so we've got health care providers. Maybe if it was for me, for example, maybe a health care provider in Red Wing, and then maybe another one at Children's over here or whatever. And what this would do is just say that whatever that legislator, those benefits that they were using at the time that they were activated, they would continue. So if their family was seeing the doctor over at Nicolet, they would still be able to go over to Nicolet, even though the member of the legislature is now a member of the active duty. Active duty members get, their families get a complete package of medical benefits, but this way it would be seamless. They wouldn't have to trade. You wouldn't have to move from one doctor to the next is basically what is going on with that amendment. Folks, we've never really needed to use this before, but it looks like we're going to be needing to use it soon. And, well, I would hope that the bill would pass committee.
Senator Murphy, what happens in other states? Are you aware that provide for something like this? Do you know?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm glad you asked that question. Colonel Olness is here, and maybe he would have a good answer to that.
Welcome to the committee. Colonel, if you would identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Colonel Eric Olness, Department of Military Affairs. And in fact, I was on the House side when that question was asked, and the representative, the author in the House, said that there were six other states that have passed legislation that would allow them to pick a temporary successor for them during the time that they were deployed.
Senator Murphy, with this, right now, when we have, if a member of the legislature resigns or leaves office for whatever reason, before or when we're not in session, and then and there's no special election because we're too close to the general, you know, a general election coming up. Mm-hmm. Would there be an impact with this proposal based on that? Or is it not?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know. I kind of see, you know, and I was kind of running a couple of these things through my head, but I don't think anybody's going to go on active duty military and then put a successor in place 3 months out from a, I don't think
so.
That
is
it would
this
be done
so?
Deliberately.
Is it permissive?
Yes.
It's at the discretion of the soldier who is called up to active duty. That person is not required to provide a list of three people for as a temporary successor. Is that true? Or not?
No, Madam Chairman. They're required under this bill to submit a list of three successors.
So there would be a scenario where, let's say it would be this year, and someone is called to active duty on May 19th. Mm-hmm. And let's say that wouldn't matter whether it's a House or a Senate member. Mm-hmm. And the member has duly filed for, that was on the 19th, and on the 18th, when filings open, that person filed for office, but they're still in office.
Mm-hmm.
So even though the legislature would not be meeting, there could be named a successor, and how would that person be sworn in?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Perry, how were you sworn in?
It was on the session day.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's the same way it would come down here, Madam Chair.
But this person would only serve until the beginning of the next session. Is
right.
that correct?
Right.
And if the member were reelected, would they have to name? They would have to name a new person if they were not back from their active duty to become a member. In,
correct.
So, is it the case that you do not have to, we do not have to be in session in order to be sworn in as a new member of the legislature? Is that not required?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's happened before, right? We've had people that have resigned, you know, during the interim. There's been a special election, and the persons have been sworn in. I mean,
I'm just asking a question.
We don't need to be in session. It just happened.
To do that, okay.
So Senator Perry just happened to have had the timing that he, by the time he was ready to be sworn in, the session to start.
I just wanted to clarify that so that that would not be, Mr. Brickwitty tells me that Senator Kielash was sworn in not during the session, and I believe.
Senator Scavel, Senator.
Senator Bonoff, I believe, was sworn in other than when we were in session. Although maybe
we came in.
Maybe not. I think. I don't remember.
I think it was in January.
Madam Chair?
Just a minute. I'm not finished. In providing for the compensation for the temporary successor, the soldier would still receive, this is a question, would still receive compensation and all benefits. Is that correct? So there would be two people from that district who would be eligible for full compensation and benefits. Senator Murphy, would you tell me the effect of your amendments?
Madam Chair, no, not pay. Only
hey,
one
would,
person under
who
this
would
scenario
be getting
is going to
the
get paid.
Salary?
The designee.
The designee, but the member would be. But would the designee be getting health care and benefits?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And the member who is serving in the armed forces would not be getting the salary or per diem, but would be his family or her family would be eligible for the health care
right.
And making contributions to
their
retirement
mm-hmm.
on the salary day, right? I mean, like on the first of the month when they would get otherwise
that's
check.
Correct, Madam Chairman. There was a
there would be that
that's part of the amendment that was put in there was
right.
so that that person could stay a member of the retirement plan that we do have, but they would have to make the contribution.
Right. Okay. Those are my questions. Senator Olsen, do you have questions or
yes.
comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I hate to ask this question, but what if this person's killed in action? Does the person that's filling in for them,
mm-hmm.
are they suddenly the incumbent, or would their term end and then it would just be a clear slate election? Or
There would be a special, the governor would call a special election.
But that doesn't exist.
Depending on when that happened.
Right, Madam Chairman and Senator Olson, this person would be assigned to fill out the rest of his term. At the end of the term, then, the regular election would take place.
Didn't say that. Really.
But if someone were,
killed
again, just using this year, as I understand it, let's say someone named a temporary successor and then the member was incapacitated, whether they died or not. They were incapacitated and would have to leave their office. Then governor would call a special election, which could be the same day as the regular general election. It would just be they would open a period of filing beyond what had been the regular period of filing.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Oh, Madam Chair, what you said was different than what Senator Murphy said. So I think we need to clarify that.
He was saying that the person would continue in
to the end
office.
Of the term, and you were saying there'd be a special election.
I believe that if a person dies in office, mm-hmm. The governor calls a special election, and that that temporary successor is only there instead of the member. And if the member is no longer able to be there, then the governor, under the current statutes, would be calling a special election, which may well be the day of the general election, as we know.
Well, Madam Chair, we should maybe spell that out in the bill then.
Madam Chair, there would not need to be a special election unless it was past the filing date. And then the special election would be on the same day as the regular election, just as Senator Wellstone's name was replaced
It wouldn't be like that.
Pardon?
It wouldn't be.
Why
statutes don't I don't think they allow for that at this point. But there would, if the person died, then there's a vacancy in office in the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe the temporary successor would get to serve out the rest of someone's term if they are if they die.
I think we should decide it and put it in the legislation. Either they serve out the term or if there is a vacancy, there's a special election.
Madam Chair.
But I don't think we're trying to make new law.
I understand what you're saying, Madam Chair.
There's already law that that provides for when a person resigns from the office or dies or otherwise leaves, and that's different than what this is proposing. Mr.
Well, then, Madam Chair, I think we should refer to that current law in here.
Madam Chair, the law governing the vacancy is actually found in the Constitution. If you look at Section 1 of the bill, this is taken from the section of the Constitution, and it actually, the amendment places the new language in the same section of the Constitution that requires it spells out the procedures for filling a vacancy, and I think was intended to supplant the vacancy when a situation like this exists. It could be you want to provide additional language within the text of the Constitution to clarify that.
So, Mr. Bonner, you're saying that this would say that if someone, it wouldn't have to even be someone who died. If this person on active duty decides that they actually want to resign their office, and they resign their office, that if we adopted this amendment and this language, the person that was named the temporary successor serves out their term. And if that's the case, if that happened in June, I would think that the people of that district should have the right to elect the person that's going to.
Madam Chair, if you say either resigns or is incapacitated or passes away in a normal situation, whatever normally applies should apply. So there should be a special election. Perhaps the special election is set at the next election, but the governor decides that. I agree with you. This person, this temporary person, is only there to replace that existing legislator. If that existing legislator is no longer there, the temporary person shouldn't be there anymore.
I think that really does respect the voters as well as making respects the voters in being able to choose, and then respects the voters in always having a representative there for them. When there's a temporary vacancy.
Madam Chair, do you think we need to add something like that, or?
Well, I don't know. I don't see Senator Murphy is not objecting to that concept.
I'm not objecting at all.
Madam Chair, while that's being worked on, I have another question.
Sure.
Senator Murphy, so it's your intention that this temporary person would serve even when the legislature's not in session, right?
Chair, correct.
Correct. The idea being, although, you know, there are times when like Senator Steben and I both went to graduate school out east, but we were still available for duties related to our office, and we may have come back periodic times, even though we were out of the state for 4 months. In this case, if someone's deployed in another country, it's very difficult for them to continue any of their legislative duties, I would assume.
Senator Murphy.
Madam Chairman, Senator Pappas, you're correct.
Okay.
it would be very difficult and if not impossible.
Okay. By email?
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, most of those soldiers don't have access to computer every night, so it would be difficult.
Okay. Senator Marty, Mr. Bonner, are you considering any language for us to clarify that if someone actually does, if there is if a vacancy in office occurs, that the temporary successor is
serves only until
a new person is elected?
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I'll work on that.
Okay. Senator Murphy, I don't know if we're going to get that all straight here, but we will.
This has to go to
we
rules
will definitely
anyway,
come back mm-hmm. to your bill before the end of the week.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but let's have a full discussion on it
sure.
now. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, just one, and I don't know that it causes any problems, but the language is kind of awkward. Like it came from another state on page 3, line 18. However, the allowance is for the district office. I don't know that any of us have district offices.
Where is that?
On line 18 of page 3. Allowances for district office of the legislature. I mean, it looks like it came from some other state's language. I mean, I think all we need to say is, however, allowances for the legislator's staff shall continue as provided by the rules of the House or the Senate. We don't provide
that's a good
for
question.
It in law.
Does that,
or,
yeah, that's
does
not
that,
a good language.
Does that mean that the person who is the legislative assistant, let's say it was Senator Pappas who was going overseas, does that mean that her legislative assistant is still on the payroll? Is that the question you're asking?
And then there would be
another person coming who would be the legislative assistant. Let's say it's just in the Senate since we get to hire our own, okay,
mm-hmm.
Rather than the way the House does it. That the temporary successor would be able to hire someone else?
Madam Chair, I believe it's, well, it's my intention that the temporary successor would just fill the seat. The staff
Take
would stay the
same.
Take the staff,
would stay it with the
right,
office.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And you know, we don't have district offices or anything like that. We could clean that up and take that out. And
Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, as a matter of fact, you could take that whole last sentence out, and it's not going to.
Probably, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Senator Marty moves that in line 318, after the period, really strike boring. The rest of the line, and then strike line 319, 320, and 321. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, I was just going to make a point that the district office very well could be our offices. It's really the Senate seat's office. It's not, you know, so that could be the office in the Capitol or in the SOB, wherever it is. Isn't that really the district office?
Well, but I think I want to be clear about whether the new person can hire somebody else. I don't know that that needs to go.
Madam Chair,
into the statutes about who's hired, and
mm-hmm.
I mean it might be that let's say that person is the new person, the successor, that we're not in session, and maybe the Senate would say, well, we're not going to hire additional staff, and to have a statute require it would seem to me to not be good policy. Senator
Madam Chair, my same point. We've got rules that take care of it when we have a new person come in or somebody depart. Rules take care of it without us stating it here.
Besides, how smart would the successor be if he came in and got rid of the staff of the person that just got him the job? That
right. Senator Carlson?
Senator Murphy, that brings up something. Madam Chair, Senator Murphy, what about if the now whose vote is stronger, the original elected person or the successor? If the successor doesn't perform well, can the original elected person unelect them, unappoint them? And do we need to have something that allows that?
Senator Carlson, we already do. There's a mechanism for recall. As a matter of fact, being the only person in the legislature to have his recall decided by the Supreme Court of the state of Minnesota, I can tell you that we could be recalled at any time.
And Madam Chair and Senator
but
Murphy,
not I by the, but right. not but by the, recalled. Not by the Armed Services member.
No, Madam Chair, the recall is the same recall that any elected official would have to go through. There'd have to be a cause, and you know, to put something in statute, you know, if the person who had the original election certificate didn't like what the successor was doing, okay, I'm going to get rid of you. I don't think we need to go there. There are those definitions of the powers and immunities and compensations and privileges, and part of that is that that person could be recalled, just
Senator,
like everybody else.
Senator Murphy, the way Section 3 reads, the person doing the appointing in the Senate would be the president of the Senate because he serves as the presiding officer, not the majority leader. So if you thought it was mm-hmm. the majority leader, it would not be because he's not the presiding officer. The Speaker of the House is the presiding officer of the House, but not of the mm-hmm. Senate. But the
did I say the majority leader?
Yes. Yeah, you yeah. did. Mm-hmm. But it's the president.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that you know me well enough that I make sure that that office is left out.
I just
out.
Want members here to be clear that it's the president of the Senate that would, to whom the names would be suggested if it was a Senate member. Okay. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, it sounds like the appointee would get all of the pay and benefits that any member would. But mm-hmm. There's something I just recall, and it always has bugged me when Dean Barclay was appointed to serve like a month or two for U.S. Senate, and I had heard that somehow because of that, he actually received a pension from the U.S. Senate, and I think that just wasn't right. And so do we have to be here for a certain amount of time?
6 years.
Before we are eligible for a pension, so it wouldn't be applicable?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, correct. Years. We've got to be here for 6 years. That's Senator Betzold's department.
Well,
what's the vesting for a member of the legislature?
The old plan would require 6 years. I mean, legislators elected since 97 are in a defined contribution plan, so they can only be here for a few years, but it's portable, basically, if they move on to another position. I mean, you know, you're not going to get much of a pension, you know, but it's kind of like a 401K.
So to that extent, yes, because they would be making a contribution as well as their employer making a contribution. Senator Gerlach.
So, Madam Chair.
Or Senator Murphy.
Madam Chair, so Senator Betzold, it would be their own money that they would put. Okay. All right.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Murphy, we've spent a lot of time talking about in the weeds or the details of the implementation of something like this and the what ifs, but honestly, I have a little problem with the idea of we elect somebody and then we're going to fill that slot with somebody who is unelected. So the constituents in that district don't have a say in who their legislator is because of this situation. So I'm wrestling with that. I really have a trouble with. You know, that whole idea. People know what their situation is. I mean, it's like we have the business sector. We have all kinds of allowances for all sorts of things, and people, we make arrangements in our private sector jobs or businesses to be here, and then now we're going to put together something so that people can escape that and be on another, you know, service. Great, but we keep finding ways to kind of get out of things we've committed to. So You know what I mean? I mean, if you're committed to your job, or you're committed to the legislature, you're committed to your, you know, your military service, whatever it is, I think that the voters should kind of have that knowledge of where you're at and what you're going to, how you're going to perform in the job, and knowing that information, cast the vote. And I don't know, I'm wrestling with trying to figure, you know, if you're going to be gone, you know, a House of Representatives term is 2 years. Deployment can be up to a year, I think. Mm-hmm. So that's half the term. Maybe there should just be a resignation and a special election. Maybe that's the alternative, something like that. I'm not saying this is totally terrible here, but I'm really wrestling with this notion of people being able to vote for the representatives, and then because of the situation, now they have somebody appointed to mm-hmm. be their legislator. I had trouble with that. So,
well, Madam Chairman, Senator Gerlach, when you talk about commitment, I don't know of anybody that's more committed to I just don't know. And is that what we don't want to do? We don't want people to be citizen soldiers, because, you know, that's the majority of our fighting force for the United States of America now are people like Colonel Alness, our citizen soldiers. And I don't think that we want to we're making an exception for people who can get called into active duty. They've already proven themselves, Senator Gerlach. I mean, you know, all of us here have proven that we've got a commitment to the state of Minnesota. Now, you know, I'm looking around, and some of it, most of us are all too old to be also in the National Guard or any other branch. I think the voters would be pleased if somebody got called up to service and they were able to continue their representation without that individual being penalized by having to resign the job that they obviously ran for and loved. I don't think that'd play very well.
Colonel Alness.
Madam Chair, members, and if I may add on that too, and I saw Senator Betzel raised up his hand, so he might have been planning to address this. If you look at USERRA laws, the federal laws that govern employment, typically you cannot require someone to resign from their position. And I would imagine that would extend to an elected position, although I'd have to ask the ESGR ombudsman or something on the specifics on that, in order to allow them to deploy. Their job by federal law is safeguarded for them during their departure and their return. It's as if they have never left. So although elected positions are a little bit different, that person, that is their job, or at least one of the jobs that they have, and it would be problematic if you had an expectation that they would resign that position in order to deploy for their country.
Okay. Colonel Alness, do you know if a member, an active member of a member of the military on active duty, let's say someone in Japan right now, wants to run, lives in Minnesota and wants to run for the legislature, and is able to come, would be able to come back and during the filing period and file for office, but then had to immediately go back to his duty or her duty. We allow that, is that correct?
Madam Chair, if that person is on active duty, they cannot register or sign the intent that they're going to run for office. In fact, if you're a member of the Guard and Reserve and you're mobilized, you have to wait until your tour of duty is complete before you can do that. In fact, we're running into that right now, where some members of the 34th Infantry Division returned in January, and they need to wait until the end of their terminal leave, until they're done with their leave, before they can register for office, because you cannot do that while on active duty. And once they're off active duty, they're a citizen just like all of us.
But someone on active duty cannot file for office, and I'm thinking, okay, and then is not here, and then wins, and then wants to name their successor while they're still away. They can't do that. Is that a federal law or state law, or is that just a military code?
That's a DOD policy, at least. But that's very consistent. There's very strict rules on what active duty military can do as it relates to any election type activities.
Okay. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I'll come back to you,
Senator. And, you know, Senator Betzel and Senator, former Senator Dean Johnson were both in the military for a long, long time, and I don't know if how did you avoid not being gone sometimes during session, or could you work your schedule so that it wouldn't be the case?
Well, Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, during the first 10 years when I was in the Minnesota Senate, I was active in the Army Reserves, and my commitment was 1 week in a month. Well, I could, and I did that during a session. I owe them 2 weeks a year, but I could do that during the interim. But the specter of being deployed was out there, and you know, and I thought of it periodically. You know, we weren't ramping up for war. We had the Gulf War, the first Gulf War in 90 and 91, but that was kind of phased out by the time I got elected here. But you know, I mean, I thought of it, and I had I been deployed, I would have resigned. I would, you know, I felt that was just what I would have had to have done, because I couldn't hold elective office while I was also serving in the military as an officer. It didn't work out that way, and but that's what I would have done. I guess I hadn't thought of the prospect of, you know, remaining in an elective office while also serving on active duty, just not having benefits, because I would have seen those as inconsistent, you know, with my responsibilities as a military officer. And it is correct. I mean, you can't run for political office while you're serving on active duty, so that would be precluded. I honestly don't know what the Department of – apparently some other states have passed this. I don't know what they would think about having somebody, you know, who's currently an elected official also serving on active duty. I don't know, Colonel, is that something that's come up?
Colonel, I'm sure, Senator, if someone is a traditional serving Guard member, they can be elected. And if they're subsequently elected, I mean mobilized or elected to office and then subsequently to that are mobilized – they can continue to hold that office because the military will not discriminate against them. But that's where some of these states have then elected to provide for there could be this temporary appointment during the time of their mobilization. Also, I mean, the time has changed since both I and the Senator first joined the military. I mean, back then it was, well, if the Soviet Union crosses a fold a gap, then we'll be at war and be mobilized. After 9/11, we've gone into this cyclic thing where we expect that we'll be mobilized hopefully in the Guard or Reserve, about every 4 to 5 years. So someone might have elected office and know that down the road, like the representative referred to earlier, he knows that he's going to be called by his branch to serve. However, at some time that might change. And in 9/11, when that happened, after that, we're getting about 72-hour notice for some of our individuals. So we could go back to a time again where we don't know, but that suddenly a national emergency occurs and then we're called to duty with very, very short notice. If it were something like this, then they would drop their list of successors and then go off to their mobilization station.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas and then Senator Perry.
Well, we also have a member of the legislature who joined the National Guard after being elected and would be up for election this summer, this fall. How does this, does that make a difference in this legislation or how we think about it?
Senator Murphy?
I don't know if it does.
Well, Madam Chairman, Senator Pappas, no, I don't think so. I think that goes back to the, you know, to the responsibility of the citizen soldier. I mean, that's the behavior that, you know, we want to be replicated over and over again. And I think that if we disallow, you know, their continued service, either in the branch of their military or in the legislature, I think that would be unfair.
So it's a little bit like, Madam Chair,
Senator Pappas.
It's a little bit like we are a part-time legislature, and many of us have part-time jobs or even full-time jobs. Mm-hmm. And so for these particular legislators, being a member of the National Guard is like a part-time job for them, except occasionally it becomes full-time. And then what do we do? And so this is a solution for that.
Senator Perry?
Madam Chair, I just make a comment because I was in the service as well. You know, I go back to when you're sworn in to uphold and fulfill the duties of the office. I would venture to say that anybody in the military right now, if they were activated, they would fully know and understand that they would be unable to fulfill the obligations that the voters voted them in on, elected them to. And I would fully expect them to resign because they cannot fulfill it. Nowhere when I was sworn in did it say if I could not fully execute and do my duties, I could appoint a temporary person. Well, I think Senator Betzold said the same thing. I mean, as a military man or woman, you are expected to fulfill the obligations of that position. And it would be different if the colonel said, well, you know what, I am going overseas, but I want to have a temporary person be deployed for me. I mean, I think we're crossing a line here Senator Gerlach said, that we're shorting our constituents or the voters, and I think we need to be careful with that. But I truly believe that any man or woman in the military service, I think knowing that they could not fulfill the position that the voters elected them to, would tender their resignation.
Madam Chair.
Well, Madam Chair, I would strongly disagree.
Senator.
I mean, that goes back to the reason why the bill is in front of us, Senator Perry.
The constitutional
is that we want people to be citizen soldiers.
Sure, I agree.
Okay, all right. My son's over in Iraq. When he comes back, he was working construction before he left. Guess what? That guy's going to hire him back on. And you know what? He's not going to hire him back on because the law says that they have to. He's hiring him back on because he appreciates that young man's service. So what are we saying as a state? Senator Lori, let's say that you were called up and off you went. What are we saying? What would we be saying to you if we told you that you can't have your job when you come back? I mean, it's the same thing any place, Senator Perry, regardless of whether we hold an election certificate from the people or not. I mean, if I was a banker for U.S. Bank and I got called up and went and served and came back, I would get my job back. And that's all we're doing here is just making sure that the constituents still have someone in that job without running through a special election. And yeah, we all know what kind of money those things cost. Elections are expensive.
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry and then Senator Gerlach still wants
Senator to Murphy, I would disagree totally. There's a difference between being hired privately in the private sector and being elected by the constituents of a territory or you know. It's totally different, and you cannot. There is no way you can compare them unless all the private people are hired. You can't compare being hired to being elected. We're elected to represent a group of citizens. I would say the best thing to do, and I know how much a special election costs. I went through one, and so did a few others. But it is the citizens are the ones that should decide what happens to that seat, irregardless of how it's vacated. I just, you know, and trust me, I like the idea, but I just don't. I think we're shorting our citizens.
Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I agree wholeheartedly with Senator Murphy that, you know, if we don't do something like this right now, there's a bit of an anomaly in our current statutes that would really discriminate against our citizen soldiers. If what your point is that they can't actually take their oath because they can't guarantee that they'll be able to fulfill their duty as a state senator, we're giving them the ability to have a backup plan so that they can, in good conscience, take their oath and say that they'll, you know, that the duties that they've taken on will be handled in a good manner. And this is a constitutional amendment that is being put to the people of Minnesota to decide whether that's an appropriate manner to handle such a temporary absence. I think that if we are not to do something like this, we're actually discriminating against our citizen soldiers in a way that I don't believe is right.
Madam Chair, could I respond to?
Oh, Senator Perry, sure.
Senator Lori, would it be better to have a vacant seat or have a seat that's being represented by a person that the voters never elected? Which is the best which would be better in your eyes, to have a vacant seat where there is no representation or a seat that's represented by a person who has not been elected by the citizens?
Senator Laurie?
Well, I think that there's something behind your question there. What you're asking is a vacancy or somebody to step in, and we're asking the people of Minnesota to decide that question by putting it on the Constitution. It'll go out as a ballot and ask the people of Minnesota whether they trust one of our citizen soldiers to have somebody stand in for them during a temporary deployment. And I would again say, if we don't give something like this, then I think you're right, that a citizen soldier that was duly elected would have a hard time taking that oath of office. And I think we ought to be able to put the mechanics in place that would allow them to take that oath in good faith. And that's what this bill is getting at.
Mr. Bodern, have you come up with any language to address that issue about someone who actually then does resign under these provisions or somehow a vacancy is created during the period in which a temporary successor is in place?
Madam Chair, Section 4 of the bill deals with the terms the temporary successor would hold the would exercise the powers of the office. And what it says right now is the successor holds the or exercises the powers until the legislator who was elected notifies the presiding officer that person can return to exercise powers and duties. What you can do would be to create two clauses there. So on page 3, line 6, after until, you could insert a colon, paren 1, and that'd be the first provision, the one you see in the bill now. And then on page 3, line 8, before the period, a second clause. So it would be after office, insert or, paren 2, a successor to the office has been elected and qualified to fill a vacancy in the office under Chapter 204D. And that would limit the successor. The temporary successor would no longer be able to exercise any of those powers once the successor had been elected and qualified.
And a vacancy had been declared, or whatever.
To fill a vacancy.
Okay. Senator Olsen moves that amendment. If anybody doesn't understand it, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Further discussion on and being able to add that amendment. I don't see any reason to lay the bill over. Any further discussion on Senate File 2586? Senator Carlson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I want to make this work. There's one area where I'm a little bit troubled, and that is where it does say on line 2.9, where it says where it's the appointment of the temporary successor, we're actually saying that elected person shall, that their designee shall be selected. So really it does take away that office from that person who is in service. So we're mandating that we take away that office. That's what it appears to be to me. This is not a permissive, that part of it's
right.
Not permissive. That person is having
right.
Their office
mandated.
Taken
it's,
away.
It's repeated on line 14 as well.
Required.
Yeah. I mean, are you comfortable with that part of the mandate that this person shall replace themselves?
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, I am, because I don't know anybody that can go overseas and continue to do this work on a daily basis. I mean, there's not any of us that don't get phone calls that don't need to be returned on a daily basis, and having someone, you know, the office being vacant, just doesn't work.
And then the next question, Madam Chair, is that
Senator Carlson,
do we see this as, you know, and I don't want to open up another can of worms, but when we get close to the campaign season, where we're campaigning, that person that has now been deployed, is that person barred from? You know, I'm suspecting that the answer is going to be yes. That person is barred from campaigning for their own seat again.
Chair Murphy?
I'm going to let Colonel take this one.
Colonel Wallace, they're on.
That one went way over my head.
Madam Chair, Senator, that's a good point, because if you are ordered on active duty, if you need to sign the paperwork to try for the next campaign, you may be legally prohibited from doing that. There is a provision where the individual can ask for a waiver of that provision from the Secretary of Defense, who then delegates that to the service secretary. So in the case of the individual representative we're talking about, he could apply to the Secretary of the Navy to have that waived so he could apply for office. And in something like that where it would be continuing that same thing, I don't know if service secretary do, but it seemed like it would be consistent they would allow him that waiver. But again, that's supposition on my part. But there is a provision where there can be a waiver, but otherwise you're right. They'd be prohibited from certainly running, but maybe even from applying for their office for the next election.
Senator Carlson again.
And I guess that would include then, you know, I mean, some of us run for 2 years, 3 years, and I'm going to assume that there might be some behaviors that are not necessarily related to applying or signing up for office, but you're also going to, you know, in one case, for instance, I'm thinking is Steve Sarvey ran for the 2nd Congressional District, and he had to make it very clear that he was not campaigning, even though he was showing up at a lot of things that were campaign related, but he could not assume a campaign stance. He could not speak. Lots of things like that. So I'm going to assume that that's probably the way a situation like this would happen with, especially a two year term.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, most of the time when the National Guard calls up people, they leave the state, except in those times when the Red River Valley floods, or we have a tornado in St. Peter, or whatever it might be, that they deploy in state. But that's at the discretion of the governor. Now, when you're at the discretion of the president, all the rules are changed. And most of the time, what happens is, and Colonel, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you get your orders, and then you deploy normally to some place in the United States to undergo 3 or 4 weeks of training. And then you go from there. So there's no, and most of the time when you go, you're going someplace overseas. There's no time to campaign or anything like that. And then when you come back, it's kind of the same thing. You come back, you go through 3 or 4 or 5 days of duty down at Fort McCoy, and you know, go through your family planning and things like that. Reintegration program, and then you're off active duty. So I think that's about how it goes.
And Madam Chair,
and I'm going to announce right now that we're not going to do the last two bills on the agenda, and at least those two. And we just have too much, and this is a very important discussion. Senator Cohen, we're going to hear yours. We're not hearing the bills of the members of the committee, not the others.
Well, that's the agenda. Last two,
it is likely that we will have a hearing on Friday. Senator Carlson,
Madam Chair,
then Senator Gerlach, and then I'd like to get to a vote so we can hear Senator Cohen's bill.
Madam Chair, by request, I'd like to have a roll call vote.
Okay. There'll be a roll call on the motion. There isn't a motion quite yet, but I'll call on you when a motion is made. Senator Rolstein?
I would like to make that motion at the appropriate time.
Okay. Senator Gerlach, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure that we're clear about this. I don't think there's anybody at this table, Senator Murphy, that is somehow anti-military or anti-veteran or opposed to citizen soldiers or citizen legislators. Sometimes, though, you know, everything in the world is not always compatible with everything else, and sometimes we have to make choices. If you want to serve in the legislature, you stand up and you run the election, you're elected. If you want to serve in the military, you do that too. And not everything always is compatible. This is the first time I'm looking at the bill, and honestly, I'm can go either way on it right now. I've got to decide momentarily, but I'm just wondering. At least, you know, we have a lot of great discussions. We had a lot of great constitutional discussions. Just last week we had an amendment, a constitutional amendment in this committee, and it was voted down. And one of the reasons was that it was the problem was trying to solve it only occurred one time in 150 years. It looks like the problem this is trying to solve hasn't occurred at all yet, but is imminent, and you know, one time that we're aware of. And so we're trying to weigh the proportionality of the response to how often does a particular problem occur. But I'm just wondering if, you know, if you can just, for the record, tell me, I mean, is it a legitimate argument? Because I'm thinking through this. We have, on the one hand, the rights, duties, obligations of an individual, legislator, soldier, and we have 70 to 80,000 voters who elected that person. And I'm trying to weigh that and thinking about, you know, where is that on the scale? And I'm leaning towards that the person elected should do the job, and if they can't, then they ought to resign. I mean, there's a couple of people here. We talked a little bit about that, and we follow those procedures for that. And so I'm just wondering if you could tell me, is it a legitimate argument to be concerned about the 70 or 80,000 people that elected that person, and are they getting the representation they elected, or are they getting a substitute? Is that a legitimate argument?
Senator Murphy.
Or am I way off base?
Madam Chairman, Senator Gerlach, I kind of see where you're going with this, but I think my argument's more basic. If our founding fathers hadn't had some discretion to serve as both elected people from, Massachusetts or from New Jersey and serve in their militia, I don't know, maybe our country would have never been founded the way that it was. But fortunately, our founding fathers did both, and we're just trying to allow anybody else that may want to do both.
Madam Chair?
Is there, Senator Gerlach?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senator Murphy, do you have some specific examples of founding fathers who served simultaneously on active duty and in the particular legislature, or is it just rhetoric? I mean, it's a real question for you. Is it legitimate to be concerned about the voters and weigh that into the factor instead of just looking at the whole one individual on the service side? Should we take into consideration the electorate and who they elected? And it's not about founding
Chairman,
the country.
Senator Murphy.
And Madam Chairman, Senator Gerlach, that's why it's a constitutional amendment. We'll all get to vote on it. We'll all get to weigh this and whichever way you want to weigh it. And Madam Chairman, Senator Gerlach, just so you know, I think I might have had one other constitutional amendment that I've carried in 18 years, so I just don't do that willy-nilly. I do believe that this going forward is good public policy, and that's why I'm offering it up. I don't know, maybe I look at it differently than some people, but it seems like there's a few people who don't like this, and then there's some that do, so let the people choose.
Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 2586, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Rules Committee. Senator Carlson?
Madam Chair, I'd ask for a roll call vote. A
roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Senator Rest?
Yes.
Senator Betzold?
Yes.
Senator Carlson?
Yes.
Senator Gerlach?
Yes.
Senator Gimsey?
Yes.
Senator Lurie?
Yes.
Senator Marty?
Yes.
Senator Olsen?
Yes.
Senator Pappas?
Yes.
Senator Perry?
Yes.
Senator Roebling?
Yes.
Senator Sieben?
Yes.
Senator Vickerman?
Yes.
There you go. There being unanimous vote in favor of the bill, the motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator,
Madam Chair.
Cullen.
Another constitutional amendment.
Senator Cohen.
Thanks, Madam Chair, members.
Good discussions on the Constitution here. And you have proposed a constitutional amendment as well. We'd be pleased to hear your discussion.
Certainly. Senate File 2260 is a bill that, a proposed amendment that Representative Lynn Carlson and I have worked on. He and I, from our perspective as chairs of the Finance Committees in the House and the Senate, have become concerned about what we think is an imbalance of power between the executive and the legislature. Obviously, constitutionally, chief executives have been given a significant amount of power. And I heard that part of the discussion on Senator Murphy's bill and I think Senator Gerlach and Senator Murphy had a discussion about whether or not assembly members at the time of the revolution served in the military. Although I'm pretty sure there's no member of the Continental Congress who served. I'm reasonably certain, but I'm not sure about the assemblies. But there was a lot of discussion at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 relative to how you handled the balance of power between a chief executive and the legislative branch. And it struck Representative Carlson and I that we ought to just take a look, not to suggest that's inappropriate as what the governor of Minnesota is doing, but to look at how, in a couple of instances, we might redress some of that. I had a bill earlier this session relative to unallotment. This is a bill which deals with the ability to call for a special session. At this point, only the governor can do it. And so if there are significant problems, issues that need to be addressed, you're putting it all in the hands of a single person. What this suggests is a way that you could have the legislature call a limited special session. Keep in mind that the special session the governor calls is not limited to anything and can go on forever. This legislation would allow the leadership in the House and the Senate, coupled with the Rules Committee, to call for the Rules Committee of each body, of course, to call for a special session. But to do so, there would have to be a special session. The special session would have to be limited to whatever the agreement was between the legislative leadership, and the special session could not go beyond 7 legislative days. So I think this is a not an inappropriate way to take a look at what's become a significant imbalance of power, and would hope members would consider supporting this and re-referring it to the Rules Committee.
Sure. Senator Betzel.
I'm sure. Senator Cohen, I've got a technical question. On page 1, line 18, it says a special session called by legislators may not exceed 7 legislative days. And, of course, legislative days are defined by statute as any day when the legislature meets, which could be over an extended period of time. However, the question that is to be submitted to the voters on page 2, line 5, is meet in a special session for up to 7 days, which I interpret to be 7 calendar days.
And Madam Chair, Senator Butzel, as I was looking at this, I realized that is the case. And so I would suggest to line it up correctly that the word legislative should be stricken on page 1.
So that the impact of that would be 1 week,
yes,
rather than a legislative day where you could have one a day for 7 weeks.
That's correct.
Senator Betzel.
Okay, Madam
moves
Chair, I'll move on page 1, line 18, to strike the word legislative.
Legislative. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Discussion on Senate File 2260.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, did you think about actually having the entire legislature authorize a special session rather than just the Rules Committee and the leaders?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, we discussed that, but if you were to say the entire legislature,
a majority
vote?
Yeah, a majority vote.
We felt that, obviously, remember, this calls for the President, Majority Leader of the Senate, Speaker, the Majority Leader of the House, that obviously those leaders would have to do this in consultation with other members of the legislature. I think a legislative leader would be hard-pressed to do this unilaterally by himself or herself. And so we thought, getting the approval of the legislature would be somewhat awkward. For instance, and the legislature is not in session. So how would you do this, by letter or what? So we allow it. We allow the leadership plus the rules committee.
Senator Cohen, you may have said this, but how many other states have provisions for legislatures to act in this fashion?
I believe there are approximately 15 states.
15?
This could be off by one or two.
This is not a Lone Ranger issue here.
No. There are a number of states that have allowed this.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bodden called to my attention the fact that the area of the Constitution that we're proposing to amend does refer already to legislative days on page 1, line 12. That is in the Constitution. If we are silent on 7 days, it still leaves an ambiguity as to whether we mean legislative days or calendar days. Although we struck the word legislative, if we mean calendar days, probably we should say calendar days, both on page 1, line 18 and on page 2, line 5.
Senator,
yep,
Cohen.
That would be fine, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel moves on line 118 to insert calendar after the word 7, and on page 2, line 5, to insert calendar after the word 7.
Madam Chair,
On the amendment.
On the amendment, Senator Betzel, I agree with your first change. I'm wondering if most people who are voting on this will know what 7 days is, and they wouldn't have a clue what a legislative day is.
Calendar day.
Yeah, I think if you change it the first one, I don't know that you need to change the second one.
It's in the Constitution.
If you're trying to be clear to the voters, I think 7 days, people think 1 week.
The change within the Constitution should say calendar, you're saying, but the common understanding of a day
ballot question
is on the ballot question might not need to be changed. What do you think, Senator Betzel?
Well, the ballot question does determine, in a way, what the Constitution is supposed to say. Now, I mean, as long as we have the bill before us, proposing that if it's adopted, this is what it's going to read. I think
calendar days. What? No, I guess that doesn't help. I was wondering if consecutive days would be a better phrase there, but you still have the issue of it. What is a day? And a day is defined.
You're making sure this is what common use is.
If the legislative day is not the same thing.
Yeah, Madam Chair. If the question is, well, we got a number of issues here. First of all, what's the question to be submitted to the voters? Whether we should just say 7 days and if that's enough. But as long as the bill is indicating that if the voters approve it, this is what the Constitution is to read, then I think certainly you would want the Constitution to say 7 calendar days as opposed to 7 days. So I think you can go ahead with the ballot question just saying 7 days, as long as the bill says we want the Constitution to say 7 calendar days.
Senator Betzel, you wouldn't think it would need to say 7 consecutive calendar days?
In which place?
I'm just asking. Not in the Constitution, not in the question. I agree with you on the question.
Well, I mean, calendar days, I think, has a common meaning to it, as opposed to legislative day, which is defined by law, which is, of course, different from anything else. It's just what the legislature says.
So, Senator Betzel, do you want to just change and insert
page
calendar on 118?
Right. That I think that.
Okay, that would be his amendment, to insert calendar after the word 7. The word legislative has already been struck.
Yeah.
All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, on the question on 2.4, why do you say shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to require the legislature to meet instead of to allow the legislature to meet? I'm just curious.
Well, it says that if the president and the majority leader of the Senate and so on decide that it will be done, then the legislature is required to meet. I mean, if those four people make the decision, then the legislature must meet. Right?
In the Rules Committee, yes.
What, you know, I mean, but.
But.
Madam Chair?
Special session suspend me.
I think you're right. What? Madam Chair?
Okay, we're going to go around the room again. We'll start with you, Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, why haven't there's an obvious absence of minority leader in the House and minority leader in the Senate. Is there a reason that we're not including the minority party?
Madam Chair, Senator Perry.
Senator Cohen.
In our discussions, again, we had a pretty wide-ranging discussion on this, and I guess it was the feeling that a decision as to, you know, when to come into session, when to adjourn the session, when to adjourn sine die, you know, the procedural kinds of issues relative to a legislative session are determined by the majority. And it's not that obviously the minority would not have a role in the legislative session, that special session, but we have always operated from a majority party status, at least for X number of decades, in terms of the operation of the body. And so it struck us that it was consistent with that to have this as the majority leadership.
And Senator Perry,
have the legislature.
For many years, the majority party in one body was not the same as majority party in the other, mm-hmm. in the other body. And depending on what party the governor would be in, you could have no agreement to do that because you might, well, more typically it's been the DFL and the Senate, but any number of the Republicans have been in charge in the House, and if they didn't agree, well, then it wouldn't happen.
But, Madam Chair, wouldn't it be wise as we look forward, though, to say, you know, if this should happen, at least one party doesn't look like the bad person in the eyes of the citizens, because we know how that is, by calling in a special session, that it has to be an agreement between the minority and the majority? I mean, I'm just seeing problems down the road.
I think I would agree with Senator Cohen on this, that the majority party, in terms of whether it's Republicans or Democrats, are responsible for setting up the processes and procedures, and so I don't see that as a huge issue. And those who have served in the Senate in the DFL, they don't know what it's like to be in the minority, but I can tell you that I do. And in serving in the House. And, you know, we just took it as a matter of course that the Speaker and the Majority Leader set the guidelines for how we were going to proceed. And sometimes we didn't like it. You know, but Senator Gerlach, did you want to speak to this? No? Okay. Anybody else? Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, I'll throw an unusual twist to you, but, you know, I don't know whether that's another issue for another day. Is it possible that the Minnesota Senate could be convene itself during the interim? And here is why it might be necessary. The Constitution provides that if there's a vacancy in either the governor or lieutenant governor's office, the last presiding officer of the Minnesota Senate then moves up to lieutenant governor. Okay, so if the governor resigns or leaves or whatever, the lieutenant governor becomes governor. If the lieutenant governor leaves, the president of the Senate moves up, which means that then there is no presiding officer of the Minnesota Senate during the time period until the legislature can convene again. And I don't know what the line of succession is if something would then happen during that time period. Is it the Speaker of the House? I mean, who winds up being if there is no presiding officer of the Minnesota Senate, because either there's a vacancy in that office or that the presiding officer moved up to be lieutenant governor?
Do you know what's going to pass?
Senator Cohen?
No, that one I had not thought of. We've had that happen once in the last, what, Al Golson? I don't know who the last person would have been before him, if there was one.
Senator Betzel?
Well, I don't. I think that the Constitution was changed to provide for that. I think that we wound up just not having a lieutenant governor for a time, for the rest of the term.
I'm sure I have to admit that's an issue we had not thought of. But Senator Betzel, you're correct that if you had that kind of a situation, you know, the Wendell Anderson, Rudy Perbich, Alec Olson situation. There is not a president of the Senate then.
And this authority would therefore not be available.
Madam Chair.
The way I read that, if that was the case. Senator Roebling?
But the lieutenant governor calls the Senate into session when we reconvene, so we wouldn't need a Senate president if we weren't convening, right?
He just means to...
Well, I'm just, in terms of... Madam Chair and Sir Roebling, just in terms of lines of succession, again, the Constitution does provide right now that if there is a vacancy in lieutenant governor or governor, the last presiding officer of the Minnesota Senate would move up to be the lieutenant governor, which means that there would not be a presiding officer of the Senate until the legislature reconvenes and the Senate were to elect a new presiding officer. Now, I don't know what that means for succession purposes or anything like that down the road. And, you know, could a new governor, could a governor call a special session of the legislature under current law for the sole purpose of the Senate electing new president in the House of Representatives? Will just have to sit there and do nothing. I don't know. I mean, it's an unusual set of circumstances, but that's how the Constitution is set up.
But during the time when that succession had occurred, the authority of the legislature to call itself into special session would not be available. That's all. The way I look at it, and because there wouldn't be a president of the Senate. Further conversation or questions? Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition of this bill? Let's see, Senator Gimsey, then Marty, then Roebling. Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question. Does upon written agreement, is that upon written unanimous agreement by all the parties? Is that to be understood? Say the Speaker of the House or the majority leader in the House says, no, I can't go along with that, doesn't sign off on this written agreement. Does that mean the special session doesn't happen then?
I think the agreement between the request among the four leaders has to be unanimous,
yes.
But the decision of the Rules Committee can simply be a majority vote.
That'd be correct.
Who is next? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, not a big point, but on the language Senator Pappas was talking about on page 2.4, Constitution be amended to require the legislature to meet. I was wondering about allow or anything. I wonder if it's more a neutral term would be to have the legislature meet. Sounds like you're going to force the legislature to meet when it's realistically going to happen. It's not allow them to meet. It's going to happen. So I just wonder if the word have or something might be more appropriate. I don't feel strongly about it.
Have the legislature meet.
Well, Madam Chair, Sir Marty, I mean, to be parallel, I mean, if the governor calls the legislature into special session, we're required to meet.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. Senator Roebling?
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Cohen, I'm just going to speak against the proposal. You know, if you can't reach an agreement with the governor to come back into session, how do we think that any bills that pass that session are ever going to become law anyway? The likelihood of an override would probably be slim at the most. And so I guess I don't really see the purpose of it. I mean, if the governor wouldn't come to an agreement with the majority parties, that we need a session. I just can't imagine the legislation coming out of that session getting the governor's approval.
Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, first let me just say for the record, someday I'm going to have a bill you like. And that is one of my goals before I leave the legislature. I'm going to have a bill Senator Roebling really, really likes.
I voted for some of your bills, Senator Cohen.
Reluctantly, though.
But so since I'm not at that point, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, this is an effort. As I said, I've become concerned with some of the checks and balances between the executive and the legislature. And there's no question we give, it's not atypical of states in the country, we give the governor more power than, say, the president has constitutionally. Line item veto, the ability to call a special session. The president of the United States doesn't have those kinds of authorities. So this is an attempt to, like I said, to, again, redress that imbalance. As to what might happen in that special session, if the governor is not called the special session, let's say this proposed amendment is law right now. Obviously, the current makeup of the two bodies of the state legislature would allow, if it was determined by that leadership, we'd have a special session. We obviously currently have a governor of the opposite party. In that hypothetical, would Governor Plenty just simply discard anything that special session might do? I don't know. Might that force the governor's hand to look at issues in a different way, to construct something different than the governor might otherwise have done? It would seem to me that's as much of a hypothetical as your hypothetical. And still does not answer the question as to how much power do we give a chief executive? And as a state, we've given the chief executive a huge amount of power. I can't suggest to you what a particular chief executive is going to think absent his or her concurrence in a special session. So I still think this offers a little bit of a slight positioning the other way. I mean, it certainly doesn't put the legislature in control. The governor still will be the more authoritative figure, but I think it does provide some limited redress of that imbalance.
Senator Marty wants to move the bill. Is there further discussion before we take that motion? Senator Marty moves that Senate file 2260 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules.
Madam Chair? I'd like a roll call.
And a roll call, right. It's good for the goose, it's good for the gander.
Senator Russ?
Yes.
Senator Betzold?
Yes.
Senator Carlson?
Yes.
Senator Gerlach?
No.
Senator Gimsey?
No.
Senator Lurie?
Yeah.
Senator Marty?
Yes.
Senator Olsen?
Yes.
Senator Pappas?
Yes.
Senator Perry?
No.
Senator Roebling?
No.
Senator Sieben?
Yes.
Senator Vickerman?
Yes.
There being 9 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails and the motion prevails. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you.
So we will.
2 minutes?
It's up to the members.
Yeah. He promised 1 minute.
1 minute? Okay.
He said the last two bills.
If it's longer than 1 minute, Senator Marty will laying it over.
Madam Chair, this is a bill passed two committees here, one in the House. It came from something probably related to prohibition, said you could not produce beverages in a basement for commercial purposes. This
this is Senate file 2916.
And it's now House file 2918 is passed over here. And basically all this does is it allows the Department of Agriculture to license kitchens not only for food preparation but also beverage preparation that might be below grade level. The department didn't know where this rule had come from, but there's a business in my district where they wanted to rent out some of their kitchens, the basement, where it was actually tea production and smoothie drink production. But they cannot allow under the agriculture rules. So this would temporarily create this law to change it, and the department would be amending the rules to conform with this. The department says they have no problem with the bill.
The reason why the bill is before us is because, not of the policy, but because of the rule.
Yes, I guess so.
Well, the commissioner is being required to amend Minnesota rules.
Right.
Is there any discussion on this bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, does this allow moonshining?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, you could produce beer in the basement if the department says your kitchen meets the standards and if you get all the federal and state regulatory things for alcoholic beverages. But
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
That's only if you're selling it. Or do you have to get all of those things if you're doing a home brew just for yourself?
Madam Chair, this is only relating to people who are commercial production agricultural products for beverages and so on.
Is there further discussion on the bill? Seeing none. Senator Marty moves that Senate file House File 2918 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Okay, we'll take those other two bills up on the